The problem is the barriers, the people getting fired on their jobs and things like that. Only one out of six union drives ever results in a contract. So the big barriers are how do you get people to risk everything? How do you get people to stick together? What are the smart strategies that people were able to do to get that kind of momentum? And then how do they take on a company? And that's something you don't get. I was thinking about one of the first big labor struggles I ever visited. When I was about 7 years old, I went down to Ravenswood, West Virginia. And those guys down there, they were locked out for about a year and a half. And they came up with a plan to go all over the world and track down eventually the owner of the company, which was Mark Rich, a financier who was in exile in Switzerland because he had sold goods to Iran in violation of the embargo, as well as tax evasion, wire fraud, a number of other things. And they shook him down, a bunch of rednecks from West Virginia. I mean, they went over to Switzerland and they formed ties with this Swiss labor movement, and then they were able to put some pressure on him in Switzerland so that he thought he was going to get kicked out of Switzerland. And that's an incredible story. Where do people come up with that desire to, instead of just give up and make a separate deal, to actually do something? And I think that's a really big question. And that almost all labor coverage doesn't get covered. It becomes this elite debate about, you know, how do unions strike the right message? We already have the right message. It's how do we come over with the boss? How do we get good contracts? How do we do smart campaigns?
That was labor journalist Mike Elk. Before that, we heard Aviva Chomsky, Holly Sklar, Saru Jayaraman, Bruce Stanley, and Scott Nova.
And that was Counterspin. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Underground Graduate School. Classes that begin in September include The Problem with Privilege, Direct Action Organizing, and Decoding Plants, Seeing Urban Flora with New Eyes. Portland Underground Graduate School is also known as PUGS. Classes take place all over the Portland metro area. Information about registering, future classes, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KBOO was born. After 48 years, KBOO Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KBOO is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll hear extended versions of two in-depth interviews. Christopher Emden, Associate Professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College, Columbia University, will discuss his book, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too, Reality, Pedagogy, and Urban Education. Plus, Stephanie DeLuca, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, will tell us more about her new book, Coming of Age in the Other America. That's coming up after the break. Thank you.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Hollywood loves a good story about a heroic and even earnest young white teacher might single-handedly save an urban public school of poor black and brown kids by teaching them to fulfill their potential. But that fantasy is also what drives many well-meaning white teachers from privileged backgrounds to teach in poor schools around the country. Well, how well-equipped are they really? And do they end up hurting more than helping? My guest, Christopher Emden, has written a new book addressing these questions and exploring an innovative pedagogical approach that works. Emden is an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College, Columbia University, where he also serves as associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. He is the author of the new book, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too, Reality Pedagogy and Urban Education. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about what you see as problematic with the way in which how white folks teach in our schools today, particularly in large cities, particularly in cities with public schools that have mostly poor black and brown kids.
So, Sonali, the larger issue really at play is not the white teachers per se. It is the approach to teaching and learning that these white teachers who come into these urban spaces come with. It is the structures of traditional schooling that reinforce a very particular approach to teaching and learning. It is the larger sort of social dynamics within schools. It is media narratives about poor black and brown young people and their propensities for violence. It is the Hollywood narrative and what it says implicitly about what the requirements are for teaching young people of color. It is perceptions of the inherent violence and anti-academic identities of young folks of color. So those things all come together and then become affixed to the persona or the teaching approach of a lot of people who come to teach in urban spaces. And what happens is that when they get into these spaces, they're so laden with misperceptions or preconceptions that are flawed of urban youth of color. They're so imbued with narratives about the inherent violence and their inability to be academically successful that the way that they're interacted with in schools becomes problematic, which I argue over time impacts how they're successful academically.
And so when we actually see the kind of training that these teachers undergo or don't undergo, do they often find themselves unprepared when they arrive in these schools? And also when they do begin interacting with these kids, do they sort of fail to acknowledge the disparity between themselves and their own school children in terms of race, class, etc.?
Yeah, well, you know, what actually happens is that the teacher training process in many instances is very truncated. So you got a couple of weeks of preparation. In the best case scenario, folks go through teacher education programs like the one that I work in. But what oftentimes happens in either that short, quick preparation program or that long-term sort of, you know, master's degree program or even an undergraduate degree in education is that the teachers are being taught just about the basics of teaching, as though teaching and learning happens the same everywhere, as though the same approaches that you would use in a more affluent, more monolithic population is the same that you would use in a more diverse or more not diverse, but sort of black and brown explicit population. So people are learning how to teach as though teaching is not contextualized. And what you oftentimes find is that these folks leave these preparation programs really believing like they know what's right to do. Like, you know, they start believing this idea of don't smile till November, be really strict, enforce your class rules. So they have this false sense of security about their training and preparation for urban America or teaching in urban America. Once they get into those spaces, it becomes there's a rude awakening, you know, within the first month or so that I was ill-prepared. At that juncture, it's too late to say, hey, come save me, because you have to save face and you're in this space. And then they just double down on ineffective practices that students react to and then trigger all sorts of things from the teacher and the student. For the teacher, it triggers a distaste for the students. It triggers a perception that the kids can't do well. For the student, it triggers this idea of the teacher has no idea what's going on, does not really understand or connect to my lives. And on the long term, on a long span, it ends up sort of affecting results, you know, students' performance, students' engagement, teacher satisfaction, teacher joy. It starts robbing the students themselves of their joy. And so what we have here is a preparation process that is extracted out from the realities of the experience, what ends up in flawed practice.
And of course, the context of all of this, which is really important, which is why we're talking about this, is because the quality of one's education impacts you for the rest of your life, impacts the path or trajectory of these Black and brown kids, our children around the country, for whom education is supposed to be the pathway to greater empowerment, you know, choices and ability to actually make decisions about where they want to go. And I want to talk about kids in STEM fields, which I know is an important issue for you. But the United States has this history, not a very good history, of just getting education wrong. And you begin your book with a historical context related to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School designed to teach Native American kids. Why is that an important starting point for thinking about modern American education?
Well, I think it's a very significant starting point because of many things. It's a Carlisle Industrial, almost technical school at the time. It was in many ways framed the same way that we frame these new STEM schools and new STEM initiatives. So the chief reason why I started there was because the structure and the intent of that Carlisle School for Native American populations or indigenous populations is the intentions are very similar to the intentions of the many sort of urban STEM schools or urban coding academies that are springing up across the landscape of urban America. And also there are a lot of similarities with indigenous or Native American culture and urban American culture. And so if you look back historically, there's a perception that this is an underclass who had no academic or intellectual value per se, and the intent of schooling is to allow them to be able to sort of have an education so they can be better than they instinctively are. Teachers are recruited based on this narrative of don't you care about having this less fortunate do better. There's this technical aspect, but there's also this implicit process of extracting out the culture of these populations as they learn. And if you heard that story, and I didn't mention that it was happening in the 1800s with indigenous or Native American populations in the United States, it would sound exactly like urban America 2016. So I begin with that historical backdrop so we are aware of the fact that this is a part of our collective history in America. It is also a model for teaching and learning that we've always used. And it makes no sense for us to identify the fact that that model was broken and did wrong by those communities and then reinforcing and doubling down on those same approaches in 2016. Another piece, a significant piece I try to highlight in the book of why we need to be able to make these connections is because if we collectively identify the fact that schooling has served as an oppressive process for people of color historically and in a contemporary, perhaps we can now start drawing connections amongst these populations to find out how we can collectively address a new approach to teaching and learning that is informed by Afrocentric traditions, that is informed by indigenous population traditions, that is informed by models like the Black Church. The idea here is that we just find new models rooted in a counter to the existing approach.
And so I want to get definitely to what you describe in your book as how teachers really can start to connect better with their students and in doing so, actually maybe even learn together. But let's talk about something that I thought was very obvious. Honestly, when I first saw the cover of your book, the first thing that I thought of was, ooh, I wonder if this is going to be a takedown of Teach for America. Right. So let's talk about Teach for America. For those of our audience who isn't familiar with Teach for America, explain what this program is and why it sort of tends to embody. I know you say in your book that you're not wanting to totally like trash this program, but why is this kind of symptomatic or emblematic of some of these problems we're talking about?
Yeah, so in the book, I do address Teach for America, and I say this is not about Teach for America per se. And the reason why I said that is because if Teach for America didn't exist as the organization it is right now, I make the argument that another organization would spring right back up. Teach for Urban America, you know. And there are many or micro versions of Teach for America that exist all across the country. So what I didn't explicitly take down TFA, which is what a lot of people anticipated, I did critique the model of TFA and similar models. And Teach for America essentially is a program that recruits a lot of students from oftentimes, you know, Ivy League or sort of larger humanities-based focused schools across the country. and recruits them to teach. These are oftentimes people who may not necessarily have an interest in education, or they didn't go into to college to be an educator. They get recruited. They go through a training program, oftentimes for a summer program, in some instances over the course of the academic year, but a really snapshot of what urban America is supposed to be is what the teachers get and how to teach effectively. And then the teachers go into the classrooms and teach. And Teach for America serves the purpose of really filling the teaching ranks in a lot of hard-to-staff schools across the country. So that's what the model is.
And of course, it's very idealistic, this idea that we can, you know, we've got these privileged, educated white people who want to do well. We've got these underprivileged brown and black kids who could use the expertise. Why don't we just bring them together and watch the magic happening? And of course, that's not what happens. So let's talk about how you, in studying children and how children themselves, within their context of their lives, of the often difficult lives they may be living in, but also their own cultural contexts, have different ways of learning and have ways that are much more suited to their own learning than someone from outside their community coming in and just stamping, you know, one size fits all models on them. What did you learn from kids?
Yeah, I mean, I want to even just take one step back. You really, really hit home on such a powerful point, which is the problem with a very simplistic model for solving complex issues. And, you know, whether we're talking about education or we're talking about politics or we're talking about, you know, any phenomena that deals with the sort of like the marginalization of people of color from being able to sort of really actualize themselves in any spectrum across this country, and I would argue across the world, it's oftentimes this: I can get these folks to help these folks and it'll all be better. The issue with that is that the whole entire model becomes predicated on a perception that a certain population needs to be saved. A certain population is not just not privileged financially, but not privileged intellectually, not privileged as far as their output of the world. So the simple model actually is predicated on a maintaining of biases against certain populations. You know, just by virtue of saying, I want you to go out there and save these kids, it's an implicitly saying that you are better than who they are. Which is a very different model than us going in and making the world better, or going in and having allies to solve a complex issue. And so part of the major problem here is us using very simple problems to address complex issues and viewing the populations who you want to quote unquote help as not having any value or having any assets or having any opinions about a change the landscape of the issue. And that leads to the question you ask, which is, what am I learning? Well, what I learn is that the answers lie within the communities that we perceive as having the problems. We can describe the challenges of urban America, but in my book, I showcase the ways that young people of color in urban settings who are being pushed into the criminal justice system actually have complex-ish ideas about how to change teaching and learning that would have helped them to be successful. Models like hip hop will tell you very much about what you can do to teach a teacher how to engage an audience. You know, when a rapper is saying, I'd like to dedicate this album, Biggie Smalls' first dedication on this album was, I want to dedicate this album to all the teachers who told me I wouldn't amount to anything. That is a signal. That is a sign that these communities are telling you that what they're getting out of the teaching and learning process is that they have no value. I would argue that no teacher probably told him, hey, Christopher Wallace, you're not going to amount to anything. It may have happened, but I doubt that that's the case. But when he's saying that I want to dedicate to all the teachers, plural, who told me I wouldn't amount to anything, he's addressing probably well-intended educators who went into that space with the intention of doing well, but through the fact that you are coming with this hubris and this fact that I need to be saved because I am less than, you are giving me a message that I lack value. And when you consistently over time tell me I lack value, I'm going to push back against the institution of education. So my take here, and what I really try to iron out in the book, is if we listen to these communities, we find a way forward. Will educators, white educators, or any educator, be humble enough to understand that the system as we have it does not have the answers of saving young people of color?
And you know, that really, I think, turns the whole idea of education on its head as well. The fact that teacher knows better, student is a blank slate on which to be written, teacher shapes student. And we do have this approach, even if we're teachers teaching in schools, in our own communities, we tend to have this approach. Whereas, of course, I think now more and more educators are realizing, people who are researching education are realizing that teachers are really better suited to be the sort of, you know, guides rather than the ones imparting knowledge. And tell us about, you have a chapter in your book entitled Co-Generative Dialogues.
Yes.
Where, and I think that's that sort of hits at the heart of how one can begin to approach really being someone constructive within an environment of an urban classroom. What are co-generative dialogues? How does one develop them and then use them as a tool?
Yeah, well, this is an approach to teaching and learning I've been working on since I was a doctoral student, you know, seems like forever ago. So, and you know, my advisor, Ken Tobin, and I just did some really fascinating work about what does it look like when you have a conversation with a young person about how they're feeling about the classroom and what will happen if you let them give you suggestions about how to do it better, and then you implement their suggestions. It's really a simple and basic construct. So, you know, what I do throughout the book is I try to give this history, and I try to tell narratives, and I try to give theory, but I also give practice. And so the co-gen or the co-gender dialogue is practice. It's essentially teaching the teacher how to identify students in the classroom who represent different groups ethnically, racially, or as far as how they engage in the classroom, and creating a space where the teacher engages with the student outside of the classroom, before students outside of the classroom, with a critique of the teacher's instruction, but not just an empty critique, but with a goal of co-generating a plan of action with the student about how to improve the teacher's practice. So the idea here is that you have this cyclic model of a feedback loop where kids are critiquing the instruction and then informing the instruction. And once that happens, the teacher ends up sort of being a malleable person who becomes, over time, shaped towards the type of student that the students need. You know, and this runs counter to a lot of ideas in education that you described before, because, you know, I come from the understanding that the teacher is the expert in content, but the student is the expert on delivering information to other young people.
Huh.
And that shifts the landscape.
So the learning happens between students as well.
Absolutely. It has to. In the best case scenario, that happens. And so once the teacher recognizes that you just happen to know more about this one thing, but the students know more about a whole bunch of other things. They know more about their lives. They know more about the culture that they share. They know more about the slang. They know more about where you go after school every day. Then the teacher starts understanding that, hey, my content knowledge is a thin slice of all the massive knowledge that exists within this classroom space. And then if we are entering the classroom with exchanges, right? If I'm willing to learn about the culture of the student, and then they'll be more apt to learn about the content that I'm delivering, and then there's much more exchange, and with the much more exchange, the student's content knowledge increases exponentially. Otherwise, the teacher is throwing content at students who are holding on to culture, and so all we are breeding is cultural clashes, which will result in, you know, disengagement.
Right. Now, let's also talk about how these models can actually enter the classroom, these ideas can actually enter the classroom, and how they can percolate within the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I mean, these are fields where people of color and women are sorely underrepresented. Silicon Valley, you know, is constantly critiqued for just having, you know, it's basically a white male-dominated field, and yet this is a field of the future. These are fields of the future. These are fields that also offer young children who might be suited to this work a chance to explore, you know, real joys. I mean, my background is in physics and astronomy, so I remember being awakened by science and mathematics in a way that I can't even describe. But most kids, especially in our urban environments, don't have that spark or don't get the opportunity to get it.
Right. Here's an interesting thing. I'm going to share a little bit of a narrative with you that I actually haven't shared with anybody else who I've talked to about this book or my work yet.
All right. So we're going to call this an exclusive. I'm just warning you.
It certainly is. Right? You know, I come to this work in urban education from not at all being interested in education. In undergrad, I was a scientist. I triple majored. I was a physical anthropology, biology, and chemistry major. My master's degree is in natural sciences. I had a life carved out for myself to do scientific research because I found it intriguing once that magic happened when I was an undergrad. And I decided I was going to teach for like, you know, I'll teach in this gap year as I figure out what PhD program in the sciences I want to go into. And it really was like, let's just have some fun and go teach. And boy, did my life switch, because I started realizing so quickly that I'm trying to give the kids all this content, all the science content. I'm thinking that they're going to love the discipline like I do. And they just pushed right back. And I kept saying to myself, but wait, guys, I'm Black. I'm from the Bronx. I'm teaching in the Bronx. You're Black and you're Latino too. You know, you should just love this thing just because. And that's what led me to teach, to write this book. Because I started realizing that I was using such an inordinate amount of energy. I mean, sweating while I'm teaching to share this passion for science. And the kids were just not connecting at all. And it was because they had gone through, by the time they got me in 11th or 12th grade, they had gone through 11 of 12 years of people telling them, this is not for you. They had gone through 11 and 12 years of opening up every science textbook and not seeing a face that looks like theirs. They've gone through every year when everybody's saying that science is for the best and brightest, while they concurrently tell them that you are not the best and brightest. So these kids are undergoing a severe psychological aversion to the disciplines that's not at all even remotely connected to their ability to do well in the subject or be awakened by it. That's what led me to write for white folks who teach in the hood. It was like seeing the fact that a majority of teachers in urban spaces across the United States are white. That number increases fivefold when you're talking about STEM disciplines. Also in STEM disciplines, we have more white males than we do white females who are in the field writ large. So those complications of it being societally perceived as a white male discipline being taught by white males or males writ large, while you're concurrently being told that it's for the best and brightest, and then being told by the world that you are not the best and brightest, those things are not about content per se. They're about psychology. They're about sociology. They're about understanding the landscape of teaching and learning in STEM fields. And that's why I focus on culture with my project, Science Genius, where kids are doing very things that are seemingly disconnected from science. I have kids writing rap songs about science, showcasing their science content knowledge. Young people writing poetry, creating podcasts about science, doing screenplays about science and science ideas. And the magic gets sparked. Once the magic is sparked and the interest is generated, they do the rigorous work on their own. But unless you do that first, unless you address the elephant in the room first, unless you talk about race, class, diversity, pedagogical strategies and their ineffectiveness, poverty, unless you talk about those things first, you're not going to get the kind of results you want in STEM.
So Chris, your book, how can it actually help white teachers? Because right now, we have lots of white teachers. The majority, as you said, are white teachers. Yeah. And they may be, you know, I may have some among my audience who are thinking, all right, fine. I take the critique. So now what can I do to actually help my kids in a real way and help myself be a better teacher? So do you see your book as a tool?
I think that's the most powerful piece of this work. I created this book with intentionality. Just to be clear, you know, I'm not just like Ivy League professor talking about teaching. I taught for over a decade in New York City public schools. I helped to start a New York City public school. I served as an administrator for a year in New York City public schools. I taught physics and chemistry in high school, taught math and science in middle school. So when I say I'm critiquing the system, in my book, I am offering suggestions. When we talk about reality pedagogy, we're talking about progenitive dialogues, which we talked about earlier. We're talking about models to have kids know how to teach their peers and themselves in the classroom. We're talking about how you give kids roles and responsibilities to ensure that they're culturally sort of connected to the classroom. I talk about this notion of curation, how you collect digital artifacts with the students so that you can learn more about their culture and about the teaching and learning process. I talk about context and how you use the context where kids are from in teaching. There are certain junctures in the book where it really turns from a problematizing of the landscape of urban education to almost like a instructional manual. So if you look through the book, you'll see, I'm like, first identify these kids, then you do this. So, you know, I think that, you know, a part of the issue in education is that you have folks who are talking about theory, they write a book about theory, they teach you about theory, and then you go to your ed course and you learn about theory and then you go home. Then there are folks who tell you amazing stories about what goes on in schools, and then you love the story and then you go home. And what I've done with this book is really connect it all. So you don't have to buy 30 books, one with great narratives, one with great theory, one with practical suggestions, you know, and then you're spending your whole entire life trying to pull it all together. You know, I believe the strength of the book is that I try to weave these things together in a really succinct way. And through this idea of reality pedagogy, give teachers a playbook while I inform them about the landscape of the field that they're embedded in.
And so, of course, the best pedagogical researchers learn by doing the right kind of research, watching how children learn best in their environment. And I want to thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today, and best of luck to you with your book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here with you. And I just want to say thank you for the brilliant questions. And, you know, I can't wait to keep following your amazing work. So thank you so much.
Thank you. My guest is Christopher Emden. He is an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science and Technology at Teachers College, Columbia University, where he also serves as associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. We've been discussing his new book, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too, Reality, Pedagogy, and Urban Education. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Sorry about the sound of my voice today. I'm just recovering from a cold. April 12th marks the first anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray, a young African-American man in Baltimore, Maryland, who was brutally arrested by police and who died in custody. Gray's death sparked weeks of rioting in what became known as the Baltimore Uprising. Several officers are currently on trial for Gray's death. Baltimore is marked by its proximity to power. It is only 40 miles from the nation's capital, and its pockets of extreme poverty concentrated in, and it has pockets of extreme poverty concentrated in African American neighborhoods. Studying this in a newly published book is my guest, Stephanie DeLuca. She's an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and she and her co-authors, Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden, spent more than 10 years interviewing and researching 150 Black Baltimore youth who were born in the late 1980s and early 1990s and who lived in the city's public housing projects. They wrote a book about it called Coming of Age in the Other America. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Stephanie DeLuca.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we get into your book and the specific topic, the research that you spent 10 years doing, let's talk about the Freddie Gray moment in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. When Freddie Gray died in police custody almost a year ago, how did you understand his death and also the community's response to it?
So I remember that there were a lot of things were happening at once. But I will just say to you, my first impression was I was on the east side of the city coming back and it was really quiet. And then I was in the central part of the city and the south part of the city and it was really quiet. And I kept seeing on Twitter and on the web that there were, you know, riots and all of this. And it turned out that there was a very small section of the city where, you know, there had been some looting and some violence. And so the first impression I had was that the media was blowing up the story into one where the city was in chaos. And so that was sort of an interesting entree into what would happen over the next few weeks, which is the way that the media portrayed Baltimore and Baltimore's youth. I think the second thing that really struck me about this period was the fact that, you know, that no one really knew what happened at Mondawmin Mall. Okay. And this is, I'm focusing more on the, you know, the unrest after the death, because a lot of what came out about how people were thinking and feeling didn't, you know, really, it took a couple more days for that to come out. And, you know, after the funeral. And so, you know, I think that there was an incredible lack of information about what had caused the, you know, the Mondawmin incident, where youth were on their way home from school and then were met with the phalanx of police officers. And then, you know, a number of stories got spun after that. And I found myself for a few weeks trying to provide a corrective narrative for Baltimore as a city and its youth.
So tell us about the research that you and your coworkers did, because that research probably informed what you were feeling last year. You spoke with 150 Black kids in Baltimore. This happened over 10 years. How did you identify who to talk to, and what sort of things were you looking for to study in a city like Baltimore?
So we never anticipated that we would be writing a book on the transition to adulthood for Baltimore's youth, or that it would be such a timely, become such a timely topic. So we started the work in 2003 because Baltimore was one site of a major federal housing experiment called Moving to Opportunity. So in the, you know, by the time the early 90s came around, the scholarship and journalism and public policy conversation was one of, you know, the perils, you know, of inner city concentrated poverty and its, you know, its devastating effects on families and children. And so there were sort of two big responses at that point. The National Commission on Severely Distressed Housing came out in 92, suggesting that we really had to think about the fact that we were unable to provide safe and decent housing for many of our low-income families. And so the federal government decided to first demolish large portions of the housing stock, the most distressed and most violent. The second was the launch of a federal housing experiment to give families a chance to move out of public housing with special vouchers through the Moving to Opportunity program. So a lot was happening at this time when in the mid 90s. And so by the early 2000s, there was some early research on the Moving to Opportunity experiment, looking at what happened when families left public housing. The results were quite mixed and surprising. You know, it looked like there were no positive effects for mothers' income and employment. Boys seemed to be doing worse, but girls seemed to be behaving better, and mothers' mental health improved. So there were some confusing results, you know, no education gains. And so we went into the field in 2003 to try to understand some of those confusing findings. And, you know, because the conventional wisdom at that time was if families can leave high-rise public housing, their lives should get better. And in some ways, they absolutely did. And in others, it took some time for this to unfold and for us to really learn what happened. So the first wave was us going out into the neighborhoods, trying to talk to families and children and some teachers to see what had happened.
How deeply embedded is poverty in Baltimore, a city that's so close to Washington, D.C.? I think that's an important context to bring up. Mm-hmm. You know, for people who have never been to Baltimore or who might only have been to those parts of Baltimore that are upscale, they're, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like a tale of two cities, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's also a tale of a wealthy region and a beleaguered city, right? So, you know, Baltimore, the east and west sides of Baltimore have been since the 1930s, you know, racially segregated, mostly African-American parts of the city, you know, and then when the public housing projects were sited on either side of downtown in East and West Baltimore, then poverty also became more concentrated. And then, you know, a familiar story to some other American cities, you know, by the 60s, you know, middle-class families and many white families had started to leave after the 1968 riots, after MLK's death, you know, which led to, you know, what became a quite a bit big population loss for Baltimore of, you know, many middle-class residents and, you know, and the segregation and concentrated poverty only increased on these, you know, two sides of the city right around downtown, while the north and central neighborhoods were, you know, where Hopkins is and further north remained white and wealthy. And then by the time, you know, roughly the late 90s, early 2000s, there was some revitalization in South Baltimore and neighborhoods like Canton, Federal Hill, Mount Vernon, which started to, you know, give the city a rebirth. The Inner Harbor, right under Rouse, was renovated and was national, you know, became internationally famous. Meanwhile, you know, our poorest neighborhoods with mostly minority families were largely left to languish. And so, you know, problems became more severe there and still more, you know, as you said, were separated from the rest of the city.
So let's talk about some of your research findings. In terms of the school life of the kids that you research, you identify these so-called identity projects in your research. What are these and how did they impact the lives of the kids?
So I'd have to say, you know, to start out with, when we went back into the field 7 years after our first wave of data collection and started spending time with the youth who were 0 to 10 when they were, you know, in the housing projects at the beginning of the original intervention, were now 15 to 24 years old. We went out to see what it was like for them as they became young adults and started launching their own lives. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a story about neighborhoods and this is a story about disadvantage. And yet in the field work, you know, in the interviews, and when we went back to the stories and the data, there was this incredible resilience, passion, you know, this wellspring of motivation, you know, and grit that was coming off the pages through the voices of these youth. And we remembered, you know, thinking at when we were doing the interviews, wow, you know, Bob was really into Japanese, you know, animation, and Bridget was really avidly into dancing, and it was all she could talk about. And, you know, Vicky couldn't stand still in the interview before she said, look, I've got to take you outside and show you my pigeons. And so there was this sort of inner life of the inner city that just jumped out. And it was one of the, you know, welcome surprises of doing the work. We then said, let's take a look at all the data and what, you know, where, what are these, hobbies and interests, and they seem to be really important. And so we looked across all of the data and identified that about half the youth in our sample had what we called an identity project, and about half didn't. And there was a very strong relationship between those who had identity projects and the youth who, you know, finished high school, entered college, and were by 2010 at least employed or in school.
So basically a kind of a passion. These are kids who found a passion in something. Could be anything, but just a passion for something.
And right. And we, you know, as we dug more deeply, you know, to try to figure out, is this different from just, you know, entertainment, or is this just different from, you know, from school? I think what we saw a couple of different things. We saw about three different types. One we call kind of the do-it-yourself identity project, which is often a private escape from difficult things, you know, family chaos and conflict, you know, difficult times. You know, these youth were experiencing an incredible amount of trauma, even, you know, years later after having, you know, left the projects. And some of these DIY identity projects were like Vicky's pigeon coop. Building, you know, she did in the backyard that she started doing with her dad. It was kind of her refuge, her escape. Dana, you know, would sit in her bedroom with the door closed, get her dad's video camera on and start, you know, just stream of consciousness talking and, you know, reciting some of her poetry and talking about difficulties. And she called it Dana's TV show. So these were sort of the more private escape identity projects that provided sustenance and sort of a sense of integrity, you know, in an often chaotic world. The second kind we noticed were more sort of peer culture, subculture, hobbies and, you know, interests that one could share with peers. Like, you know, Bob became very involved in these, Magic the card, you know, the Gathering card game, Pokemon, and the Japanese anime. And this created a subgroup of youth who were trying to be academically engaged, but were finding it hard, you know, to separate themselves and not get picked on. And they just really bonded together over these unique, not typically interests that Black youth in Baltimore were engaging in. And just sort of, as Bob put it, said, you know, we were different and we didn't fit in. And in some ways that not fitting in is what really helped us get through school. The third kind, which we call the sort of institutionally supported identity project, are things like the junior ROTC, this police explorers program, a business academy inside of a high school, community theater, so some of this more vocational programming, at a youth opportunity center, something that has a support so that activities are structured, there's community. And many of these activities that actually then can link to future, post-secondary education or job interests, and gave youth a really strong sense of what they were about. You know, Cody would wear his police explorer's badge and say, you know, I'm proud to be a police explorer. So there were definitely these different sort of types of identity projects.
And you found that those kids who did have those versus kids who didn't did significantly better in terms of staying at school, in terms of graduating, in terms of maybe finding a job, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, we loosely call it being on track. You know, by 2010, were youth either in school or employed or both, which characterized actually over 80% of our youth, which is one of the big surprises in the study as well. Fewer than one out of five youth were what we call disconnected. And what we noticed is, that one of the strongest predictors of being on track was having an identity project. Right. And the institutionally supported identity projects seem to have the strongest effect of keeping kids on course. And part of the reason we think this happens is not only is this just meaningful and fun, and something to be about. Everybody wants that, right? These youth are hungry, looking for something to be about. But it also, sparks and inspires the gritty behaviors that are required to stay the course. You know, this grit conversation was getting really popular, the last few years. And we sort of argue in the book that grit doesn't just show up out of nowhere. It needs to be inspired. And that's sort of another interesting thing that we think is behind the identity projects.
And what is what role does the issue of housing play? You referred to it earlier, but housing, of course, is one of the most important things when it comes to families, has stability, staying together. How hard is it to afford housing in Baltimore? And second, through your research, what did you find out about how where you live defines how your life turns out in the city?
Yeah, I'll take the sort of the second question first. I think that right about now we've got 30 years of social science research that is pointing to one very clear and compelling fact, which is it's not just the family you grow up in that determines your fate, but the neighborhood. The neighborhood you grew up in, and not just the family you're born into.
And in a way, Freddie Gray's fate was determined by where he lived, right?
Yeah, it's shaped is probably the word I would use. I think there's always a combination of family, school, and neighborhood. But what we're starting to see, and this was clear in some recent research that Raj Chetty, Larry Katz, and Nathan Hendren had done on the Moving to Opportunity study, which our book was born out of. They looked across the five cities at the youth who left the high poverty neighborhoods with the MTO vouchers as they, about 20 years later, as they became adults with matching with IRS data, and were finding large gains in earnings, college attendance, marriage, and really big gains, big dividends to escaping concentrated poverty. We've started to see a convergence of this evidence, which is, really encouraging in that it tells us we've got one really, we've identified an active, important ingredient that's a policy lever that we can do something about. And in our book, we talk about the fact that, while there was heterogeneity, differences in how youth turned out at the brink of adulthood, if we step back and just look at all of the youth in our study and compare them to their parents, we saw huge intergenerational gains. you know, across the board. So, you know, only about a quarter of the parents of the youth in our study had finished high school. 6% got GEDs. So that's about a third had a high school credential, and over 70% of the youth in our study had managed to complete high school.
Wow. So that's pretty significant. I want to remind our audience that I'm speaking with Stephanie DeLuca, and we're talking about her book, Coming of Age in the Other America. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're going to keep Stephanie on with us for an extended interview that you can hear on our website and watch on our website. Again, that's risingupwithsonali.com. Stephanie, in your book, you bring up an essay that a white resident of Baltimore named Tracy Halverson wrote during last year's uprising called Baltimore City, You're Breaking My Heart. And in it, she sort of, you know, in a sincere way, tried to point out how the youth of Baltimore were kind of freaking her out, you know, that she looked as if she felt like she was prey. What did this essay represent in terms of relations between Baltimore's white and black residents?
So what's really interesting, actually, is the essay came out a year before the unrest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I remember saying about maybe February, March of 2014. And what's telling about that, right, is that these issues were, you know, already, you know, were part of the bedrock of what was going on in Baltimore, you know, that this tension between, you know, residents in some of the more affluent white neighborhoods that were butting up against or, you know, near some higher poverty neighborhoods. So I think that I remember being incredibly moved by the piece and immediately thought, wow, this doesn't represent what we're seeing in our study, which is the same thing I felt when watching the media coverage of the unrest. It's a very narrow slice, you know, very narrow portrayal of youth in Baltimore, as thugs, you know, threats, right? And what you see often, you know, with some coverage of these types of things is a focus on the most publicly aggravating, threatening, images of inner city life. And when you focus on that, what you miss is everybody else who's in the house doing homework, at work, you know, training for dance or football, you know, or doing a whole bunch of other things, which it turns out was more than 80% of the youth in our study. You know, and I think that on the one hand, you know, there's certainly it's worth paying attention to the most troubled youth and, you know, and violent crime. I think that the risk you run with essays like that in certain kinds of quick turnaround media coverage is that the extreme, you know, the exception becomes the norm. And that doesn't help us, right? It continues to make us think, well, those kids are threats to us and our kids, right? So I think that's why as sociologists, we wanted to really put a more balanced view out there. You know, it wasn't their delinquent behavior that got these youth in our study. It was their shared origins. And what we see is there's quite a bit of variation in how they, you know, end up at the brink of adulthood.
What about relations between the Black community and police, which is, of course, a really important issue? You mentioned that some of the kids in your study were in ROTC, and that was actually a good thing for them. But in their day-to-day life, did you notice interactions with police that had detrimental effects on kids? Did they talk about it? Was it something you even studied?
So, you know, it came up, we asked, you know, explicitly about it, you know, because it was when we started our study, you know, there were still quite a few families living in public housing, and there was a lot of concentration of police attention in some of these complexes, you know, and it was sort of, you know, it's if you live in Baltimore, right, I mean, you can sort of feel it's present in you know all neighborhoods on the east and west side where we were spending time. So we definitely asked about it. But it wasn't an overwhelming story across the board. You know, it wasn't anything we focused on in the book, even because it wasn't the story that we were hearing over and over again. But what we did hear from those youth who, you know, especially the young men, of course, you know, was this sort of frustration, you know, and a sense that, you know, they could clearly say there are some good cops and some bad cops. We know some are trying to do their jobs, but, you know, I can't even walk through my neighborhood without getting stopped and say, man, I live here. And what was really interesting is we had a couple of young men in the study. You know, one I mentioned earlier was part of the Police Explorers program, and he would wear his badge. Another young man, Antonio, worked as a Hopkins security guard, and he wore his badge. Another young man named Gary worked as a GNA, you know, at a facility for older folks. And he always wore his scrubs and badge when he came in and out of the neighborhood, because when police would pull them over, right, they would say, look, I'm a working man. I'm not the suspect, right? I'm wearing a badge. I'm wearing a work uniform. There was sort of this really heartbreaking
He had to aspect. Keep proving himself and his innocence.
Yeah. And, you know, and this is, right, I think in some ways, right, some of these activities were identity projects that were already helping these young men, you know, sort of aim for a brighter future. But there was also a protective effect. You know, the guy in the blue jeans, the baggy jeans and the white T-shirt, well, it's not you, because you're wearing a uniform. I mean, that came through quite a bit. But we did hear of some traumatic interactions with police. A lot of it was just the capriciousness, you know, feeling always targeted. We went back actually last summer and did a rapid turnaround research project supported in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the 21st Century Cities Initiative at Hopkins to talk to youth in the wake of the unrest. In Penn North, Sandtown, and Upton, you know, some of the neighborhoods right around, you know, where a lot of the unrest was happening, and ask them about, you know, what they were thinking about their city. And we're working right now on a brief that will release soon. But one of the things that came through there too is, you know, they said, hey, you know, look, you know, we think this isn't even about race, because so many of the police are African American. We feel like it's about power, and that, you know, there are lots of places where people don't want us to be.
And then also, and so, is the underlying issue and the overarching issue poverty, right? I mean, in the end, the social class combined with the race of these young kids, the poverty and the fact that as poor Black kids, they are seen a certain way, they are tracked in a certain direction. It seems to be what impacts our lives more than anything else.
Right. And, you know, and it's interesting to go back to the Halverson essay, the Baltimore You're Breaking My Heart essay. There were a few responses written by other city residents that said, you know, listen, this is about poverty. This isn't even about crime, right? This goes back to this being about poverty. And, you know, and I would argue, and this relates to the, you know, earlier question about housing. You know, when we think about root causes, right, of this, you know, correlated, compounded disadvantage, we go back to the fact that Baltimore, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, was the nation's pioneer in legalized racial residential segregation. Baltimore was the first city to say it's illegal to move to a block where you're not already in the majority, right? I mean, so you had this sort of formalized segregation, right, compounded with then, you know, lending patterns, redlining, the siting of public housing projects and only, you know, already disadvantaged segregated neighborhoods. You know, so there were, you know, federal housing policies that contributed to this. And in addition to, you know, private sector activity, you know, whites avoiding some of these neighborhoods, blockbusting, you know, landlords and property owners scaring middle-class residents in West Baltimore, right? So this all sort of continued all the way through to, you know, the Wells Fargo case in Baltimore, where, you know, Wells Fargo was sued for, you know, essentially wealth stripping, you know, West Baltimore by, you know, with predatory lending schemes. So housing and the siting of housing, and it's a very deep part of this story that I can't overemphasize.
Mm. Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of the insights from your book. Of course, we can get to all of it, but people can pick up a copy of your book, Coming of Age in the Other America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. We've been discussing her new book, Coming of Age in the Other America. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's membership drive is coming up in September. Help us promote the work of this amazing station by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and now Snapchat, rating our app on the iTunes and Google Play Store, and joining our Facebook event for the upcoming membership drive. Oh, and don't forget to join or renew your membership. Just click donate on our website or app and start your monthly contribution to your community radio, KBOO.
Join KBOO Community Radio at Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, September the 8th for United We Stand Up, a comedy show and a benefit for KBOO. I'm T6 and I'll be your host that night, which will feature local